the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Liz Ortenberger, CEO of SafeNest. The organization has their Pathways to Hope brunch fundraiser and Run for Hope 5K both coming up. Liz, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So for those who aren't familiar, what exactly is SafeNest?
Yeah, SafeNest is a comprehensive domestic and sexual violence agency. So we work not only with survivors affected by domestic and sexual violence, but also with abusers and with children affected by these epidemics.
Okay. And how does SafeNest compare to other organizations that might also serve clients who have experienced domestic and sexual violence?
Yeah, great question. So what differentiates us a lot of the time is the expanse of services that we have. You know, we not only work in the traditional space, which people generally associate with a shelter and a hotline, which we definitely operate, but we also work in the prevention space with children who have been affected by domestic and sexual violence to try to break the cycle. Many of those children will repeat the cycle without intervention. And then we work in the empowerment space where we do transitional housing, long-term mental health supports, and U-visa, T-visa support, and many other things. We also are very active in the state legislature, making sure that Nevada is safe for everybody. And last session, for example, we passed a bill with the help of Assemblywoman Summers Armstrong with more than $2 million of funding for strangulation exams, which is one of the biggest red flags for not only domestic violence homicide, but also mass shooters and cop killers. So we work expansively across the movement to elevate what the community understands, make us all safer, but also end the violence for families that are experiencing it.
Wow, that's awesome. So how do people access services when they need them?
Yeah, great question. So you can call, text, or chat with us. You can call or text our main number, which is 702-646-4981. I have advocates on those hotlines 24/7, and we can access any language for support for folks. And if that doesn't work, folks can go to our website, safeness.org, and they can open up a confidential chat with a crisis advocate to get the support they need. That's really how you open the door to survivor services or even abusive partner services to start getting connected with the right services within the agency for you. You know, I tell everybody, not everybody who calls needs shelter, but those folks might need a temporary protection order, or they might need some mental health support, or folks might just need some help with groceries or housing while they're navigating an incarcerated provider, right? If that person who is the perpetrator is also the provider for the family, they might need some financial help while he or she is navigating incarceration. So there's a lot of stepping stones within the domestic and sexual violence trajectory that folks might need help with. And those are the ways that they start to get access.
Okay, that's great. Now, what's your personal background and your history with SafeNest?
Yeah, so I've been at the helm of SafeNest now for 7.5 years. It has been a tremendous honor to be able to be the CEO and lead not only a team of dedicated and incredible staff, but also volunteers, and hear from our phenomenal survivors the success that they've achieved in their own life goals. So that has been my history with the agency.
Nice. Okay. So what's the upcoming Pathways to Hope brunch fundraiser all about?
Yeah, so this is exciting, right? This is an opportunity for us to highlight really the courage and strength of not only our survivors. We will be honoring 8 survivors that day with a Pathways to Hope Award, which includes a $500 scholarship, which we're really proud of. But we'll also be honoring some of our abusive partner participants that have been through abusive partner treatment program and have worked through, you know, their own behavior and what that's done to their family. And finally, we will celebrate our kiddos that get involved with us in our program. And we take them away to camp every summer and then do programs year round, and we'll celebrate them as well. So it's really in all buckets, right? With our kids that are affected, our survivors that find the courage and the hope and the resiliency to survive and then thrive after abuse. And then our abusive partners that are really making decisions to make changes in their life for either the family that they are still with or the new family that they may create. So it's a celebration.
And where and when exactly does that take place?
Great question. So it's at the Red Rock Casino, and it is on September 21st. The pregame or the fun part is 10 to 11. We do a lot of fun games. We don't have a traditional silent auction. Instead, we have a lot of fun during that first hour. And then the program runs from 11 to 1.
And what specifically do the funds raised go to support?
Yeah, so for our brunch, the funds go specifically into our client services budget. So that helps us fill in the gaps where maybe other funding does not. So an example of that I always like to give people is, you know, one of the things we recognize is when folks come into shelter, sometimes their stuff is all in trash bags because they fled in the middle of the night. And one of the things that we like to do is provide them with suitcases. And that's sort of the first step towards healing and dignity. You know, it's very hard to feel like a dignified individual if you're looking for your stuff in trash bags. It's different when it's a suitcase, right? It's things like that that brunch goes to help fund. It also helps send kids to camp. We took 120 kids to camp last year. These are kids that have experienced domestic and sexual violence. And the program at camp, while a lot of your traditional camp fun, is also designed to build their hope so that we can break the cycles of violence for these young people. And then it goes to help things like I mentioned before, you know, I need help with groceries. The person who provides for the family is incarcerated because of the abuse. How do we help you navigate that? How do we then provide housing counseling? How do we do all of those things? So those are all things that fall within our client services realm, and that is what the brunch goes to help fund.
Okay, so that's the Pathways to Hope brunch fundraiser, and then you also have the Run for Hope 5K coming up. Tell us about that.
We do. It's on October 13th at Wayne Bunker Park. And it's a fun day. Everything we raise this day actually goes to our pet program. We house pets in shelter with survivors. And dogs are welcome to come out and do the 5K or the 1 mile fun run. And this is just a day to enjoy being out. Hopefully the weather's nice, which it usually is that time of year. And just have a good time, get a little exercise, stretch your legs, and hear a little bit more about SafeNest and enjoy.
Yeah, awesome. So speaking of pet program, help us understand why that's so important.
Yeah, you know, for a lot of people, their pets are a critical part of the family. And really, for survivors, that goes in two ways. One way is often abusers have said, if the pet is left behind, I'll kill it or I'll hurt it, right? Imagine that, like your beloved pet, right? If you leave it behind. So for that reason, many survivors don't leave. For the other reason, the pet is sometimes the beloved family pet when you have kids in tow. And you are already asking so much of your kids leaving a domestic violence situation. To have them lose their pet as well can be really difficult to overcome, right? So what we realized years ago is that it's important to make sure that we have shelter and housing for everybody. And so we wanted to make sure that there was no barrier for a survivor who needed us to not be able to get support. And we added the pet program, and we love it. And this 5K goes to help fund it.
Nice. Okay. Now, you mentioned that the Run for Hope 5K is happening on October 13th at Wayne Bunker Park. What time does that get underway?
Yeah. If you want to register that day, I recommend getting there around 7. I think the run starts about 8 or 8:45, but the exact details are on the website at safeness.org. So just make sure you check that out. Also, if you want to pre-register, you can do that there as well.
And it's called the Run for Hope 5K, but can people walk if they want to?
Absolutely. We have no marshals out there making you run. you can absolutely walk it. And there's a 1 mile as well, which my kids love doing every year. So yeah, there's options for both.
Nice. So you mentioned the website safeness.org. And obviously, that's where people can get more information about the organization. What if they want to become a volunteer?
Absolutely. Yeah, really the hub of everything is safeness.org. We also have a volunteering section under there if you click get involved. And it'll take you to some information about our volunteers and then an application. So we are always looking for volunteers. It is not easy to work on the front line with survivors in this space. But if you feel like that is something that you'd like to do to make a difference, we would love to first support you in the training and the process and then help you get active with our program.
Okay. And then they can get tickets to the Pathways to Hope brunch fundraiser or sign up for the Run for Hope 5K, all at safenest.org as well.
They can. And also, if they have things in their home that they no longer need, you can also sign up for us to send a truck to your house to grab that stuff. So we also do used goods pickup. So lots of ways to give back to SafeNest, and we certainly appreciate every gift that we get.
Wow, that's fantastic. Okay, so once again, that website, safenest.org for all things SafeNest, safenest.org. You can find out more about the organization, what services they offer. You can click on Get Involved, sign up to be a volunteer. You can have a truck come out to pick up goods that you want to donate. And if you want to get tickets to the Pathways to Hope brunch fundraiser or sign up for the Run for Hope 5K, that's all there as well. Once again, the Pathways to Hope brunch is September 21st at Red Rock Resort Hotel and Casino. Starts at 10 a.m. with the fun and it runs through till 1 p.m. And then the Run for Hope 5K is on October 13th at Wayne Bunker Park. And you can pre-register online or it gets started at the park at around 7 a.m. Once again, all of that, safenest.org. And of course, we've been speaking today with Liz Ortenberger. She's the CEO of SafeNest. And Liz, it's been great talking to you and finding out all the resources that you offered to members of our community who are in need of those services, the education pieces, the pet program, all of that fantastic work that you're doing. And I really appreciate you being here sharing it with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
In 1945, the original care package inspired people around the world. Today, we're reaching 170 million people in over 110 countries. Because when history repeats itself, so does care. Join at care.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Lori Thomas, Executive Director of the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. The museum's annual Dinosaur Ball Gala is coming up at the end of September with a Night on the Nile theme. Lori, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
So, when was the Las Vegas Natural History Museum first established?
It was first established in 1989, and we opened our doors in July of 1991. So, we just celebrated our 33rd anniversary.
Nice. Okay. And what do the exhibits focus on?
Basically, they focus on natural history. So we have several different exhibits. We have a International Wildlife Gallery, which featured taxidermy animals, and we talk about biomes in that area. We have a marine gallery that has live sharks, live fish. We have a Treasures of Egypt gallery that features a King Tut exhibit. It's the actual recreation of his tomb. We go anywhere from Africa to prehistoric with our prehistoric gallery. So we go basically from the desert to the ocean, from prehistoric times to current times.
Awesome. And what's the upcoming Dinosaur Ball Gala all about?
That is our annual fundraiser. The Dinosaur Ball raises funds so that we can support our education program. So we have recently brought the dinosaur ball back to the museum. We used to do it in the hotels and we would have it in their ballrooms. But after COVID, we brought it back to the museum and we discovered that people loved having it back here at the museum because they got to see where their dollars were going and what it was doing to help support the community. So since 21, we have continued to have the dinosaur ball here at the museum.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's a nice environment for people to be able to be part of the whole thing.
Absolutely. What we found out was a lot of people who were attending the ball at the hotel ballrooms had never been to the museum. So this is a way to get them into the museum to see our beautiful museum here.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, why is the theme this year Night on the Nile?
Well, we change the theme every year. It's always a dinosaur ball, but we pick different themes every year. This year, we just decided to do a Night on the Nile because we've got our Treasures of Egypt gallery. And having that theme can bring a lot of fun to our fundraiser. So we're excited. Instead of having a red carpet, welcome everybody to the museum, we'll have a blue carpet that they're walking on the Nile into our museum. Obviously, we will have activities such as a mummification presentation from Ellis Rice, who will actually become a priest, and he will do the mummification process and show everybody how that works. And it just really lends itself to a lot of really exciting things for the evening. The decor and the atmosphere will all take on a Egyptian flair.
Who will you be mummifying?
You usually grab somebody, a guest from the ball. So
okay. So yeah. Not like really mummifying.
No, you usually grab somebody, they lay on a table and he explains as he goes what they do. And of course, they're supposed to play the part. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that would be. That sounds fascinating. Now, why is the gala honoring MGM Resorts International?
MGM Resorts International has been one of our longtime supporters. Annually, they give us a grant to help support our education department. They helped actually build the Treasures of Egypt gallery that we have right now. They helped fund that. And they just have been supporting us for many years in a really great way to help fund exhibits, education programs, as well as a few other things. And so we wanted to honor them and thank them for their longtime support.
When you talk about the education programs, what kind of programs does the museum have on a regular basis?
On a regular basis, we have our weekend science program. So every weekend, we have multiple different programs going on. On Sundays, we have a literacy program that's going on. So they read a book. We have dinosaur puppets that interact with the guests while they're reading, if that's on theme. Then there's an activity afterwards, which goes with whatever theme of the book that they are reading. On Saturdays, we have different themed activities. They're themed for each month. And that's a different theme for each month. For instance, this month, we've been learning about sloths and all sorts of other critters, bats and things like that. But everybody can always go on the website and check out those types of activities. Of course, throughout the school year, we have field trips just about every day that field trips are allowed in here. We also have coming up will be our Hispanic Heritage Month. So we are having submissions by different artists to celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month. And we will have a VIP reception with that. And then we have other programs like DTR, which is December to Remember, which celebrates different cultures and the way that they celebrate the holidays. And of course, that starts the day after Thanksgiving, and that runs all the way through January 1st. So there's just a multitude of activities that always go on throughout the year.
Okay. So the Dinosaur Ball Gala is honoring MGM Resorts International, but who are some of the sponsors for the gala?
We have Corrigan Companies, Wynn Resorts, Cox Communications, City National Bank, Bailey Kennedy, Attorneys at Law, Califano, Nevada State Bank, Bank of America, Trident, as well as some of our board members, Carol Levins and Susan Houston, also by sponsorships.
Okay, nice. So the Dinosaur Ball Gala is happening at the end of September, but what are the details as to when exactly it's happening?
Yes, September 28th. We open our doors at 6:30 and it goes from 6:30 to 9:30.
Okay. And you said it's at the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. And for people who don't know where the museum is located, where is it?
It's located at 900 Las Vegas Boulevard North. It's just between Cashman Field and the old Las Vegas Mormon Fort.
Okay, awesome. And you mentioned the website. People can go there for more information. So how do people find out more, first of all, about the Las Vegas Natural History Museum in general and some of the education programs that you mentioned are going on a month-to-month basis, or get tickets to the Dinosaur Ball Gala?
We actually have two websites. We've got our regular website is the Las Vegas Natural History Museum website. That's lvnhm.org. And if you only want to learn about the dinosaur ball, it actually has its own website and it's dinoball.org.
All right, perfect. So once again, the website for the Las Vegas Natural History Museum is lvnhm.org. Of course, that stands for Las Vegas Natural History Museum, lvnhm.org. And again, the museum's located at 900 Las Vegas Boulevard North. It's the corner of Washington near Cashman Field and the Neon Museum. So lvnhm.org. And then if you want to find out more about the Dinosaur Ball Gala, which is coming up on September 28th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Las Vegas Natural History Museum, the website for that is dinoball.org, dinoball.org. And again, September 28th, 6:30 to 9:30 at the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. And we've been speaking today with Lori Thomas. She's the executive director of the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. And Lori, it's been fascinating talking to you, first of all, about all the things that the museum has going on. And I think it's one of those unsung treasures in our community that it has such wonderful exhibits, but a lot of people have never been there, even though it's right there. It's so convenient.
Yeah.
So thank you for letting us know more about the museum and the different programs you have going on. And of course, the annual Dinosaur Ball Gala, which is your flagship fundraiser coming up at the end of September. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure to speak with you.
We are the 25%. That's a quarter of all Americans, over 61 million people with a disability. And we want a world where everyone is 100% included, just like you. Easter Seals Disability Services. We are the 25.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Chad White, General Counsel for Brookdale Senior Living. According to the FBI Internet Crime Complaint Center's most recent elder fraud report, crimes against seniors increased by 11% last year and led to more than $3.4 billion in losses. Chad, thank you so much for being here today.
Heather, thanks for having me.
So why are scams against seniors increasing?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. One of the main reasons is that seniors were raised in an era that valued politeness and good manners, but that makes them more vulnerable to fraud. They also can be targeted because many of them have built nest eggs, they own their own home, and so they have assets, and they're being targeted by criminals.
Okay, now what are some of the most common scams that target seniors?
Well, one of the most common types is family and relationship scams. These are ones that pull at the heartstrings, they exploit loneliness, or they scare victims into thinking that a loved one's in trouble. Another type is identity theft or phishing scams. These are ones where you might get an email from a vendor that you're used to doing business with, or that purports to be a vendor that you're used to doing business with, and they're asking you to provide credit card or other login information because they're claiming that you didn't make a payment. Another very common one for seniors are non-payment calls, and these are where someone makes a fraudulent claim that you haven't paid your taxes or you haven't paid your utility bills, for example, and they're demanding immediate payment.
So some of these are obviously going to be difficult to figure out whether it's real or not. So what are some of the telltale signs of a scam?
Yeah, one of the clearest signs that you may be subject to a potential scam is if someone demands money immediately or urgently. If they tell you you need to act now, that's a warning sign. And Heather, if they tell you not to tell anyone else, that's another very clear warning sign. One of the other ways that you can tell it's potentially a scam is if the other party threatens to contact the authorities if you don't act urgently. One other way that I think people commonly can tell that it's potentially a scam is if they ask you to wire money, particularly if they ask you to wire it overseas, or if they ask you to pay with a gift card or cryptocurrency or something like that.
Okay, so basically they're playing on emotions. There's going to usually be a sense of urgency and maybe a non-conventional method of payment.
Absolutely. I think those are some of the key areas. One other thing that I think is out there is if you get an unsolicited email or text, that can be a potential scam or a phishing exercise. So if an email or text is asking you to log into a site or open an attachment, you need to be suspicious of that.
So then how can we protect ourselves and, most importantly, those we love who may be seniors from getting scammed?
Well, Heather, I think the most important thing first is for seniors to be very suspicious and be very cautious. They need to take time to research if they get a call or if they get an email that's asking for action. If a caller or visitor tells you to act immediately or does not give you time to research or think about the request, that's a huge red flag warning sign, and I think people should feel free to hang up or walk away. It's okay to hang up, and it's okay to walk away in those circumstances. I would say never wire money based on a request over the phone or in an email, especially if it's being wired overseas. Again, don't click on links or open attachments and emails or text messages that you weren't expecting. If you get an email that says you haven't made a payment, go directly to the website of the business that you're doing business with rather than clicking on that email link, or look up their legitimate phone number for customer service and call them directly.
Okay, yeah, some great tips. Now, how does Brookdale Senior Living help educate its residents and families about scams?
Well, thanks to Brookdale's size and scale, we have access to resources both within our corporate support centers and across the country to help keep our communities informed and protected. For example, some of our Brookdale communities welcome local security or finance experts to share up-to-date information with residents and families when it comes to scams targeting seniors and trying to provide tips on what they can do to help prevent becoming victims.
So where can listeners go if they want to learn more about how to avoid becoming a scam victim or protecting our loved ones from fraud?
Heather, I would encourage your listeners to visit our brookdale.com website. We have a lot of additional information regarding scams and how to identify them, including links to other helpful resources such as the FBI on the website.
All right, fantastic. So once again, that website is brookdale.com, brookdale.com, brookdale.com. It's the website for Brookdale Senior Living. You can also find plenty of advice there about how to avoid scams, some of the tips that Chad's been talking about today, how to spot it, how to avoid it, how to protect your loved ones. And we've been speaking today with Chad White. He's the general counsel for Brookdale Senior Living. And Chad, it's really important to bring these types of issues to the public, and we want to stop this increase of crimes against seniors. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Heather.
So much of our lives are online today that it's hard to know if we're being scammed. Keep your online information secure with simple steps you can take today. To learn more, go to CISA at cisa.gov/secureourworld.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Tahir Rahman, Associate Professor of Psychiatry, guest lecturer at the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit, and author of the new book, Extreme Overvalued Beliefs, which takes a look at the shared beliefs behind most mass attacks. Dr. Rahman, thank you so much for being here today.
Heather, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what inspired you to write your new book, Extreme Overvalued Beliefs?
Well, we've got a real crisis in America with shooters, mass shooters, school shooters, terror attacks, and we really don't have a good classification system for describing the criminal behavior that occurs. And so I set out looking for a way to approach this using more of a public health approach.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that we have a lot of school shootings here, and it seems unique to the U.S. that there are so many school shootings. Why is that?
It's a good question. I think the short answer is that many of the school shooters identify with previous school shooters, so there's a contagion effect that occurs. And obviously, the United States has easier access to some of the more lethal types of weapons. But that's not the only reason. The fact is that shared beliefs, and not psychosis-like delusions, are the cause, and that's the extreme overvalued beliefs that I discuss in my book.
So where do these extreme overvalued beliefs come from?
A person is collecting grievances. Let's say that they're upset with folks around them or what's going on at home. And those kinds of feelings of grievances and loss make people search for other types of solutions to their issues. And so an extreme overvalued belief is a fixation that's shared by others in a person's subculture group. And often those are found online. So for instance, some of the shooters that we all know about, you know, the Sandy Hook shooter, Adam Lanza, the Parkland shooter, Nicholas Cruz, the Uvalde shooter, Salvador Ramos. And other shooters will find these depraved online subcultures, which they then become enthralled with and actually relish and enjoy and develop a real, almost like a luscious fantasy about what they're going to become by doing one of these shootings.
So is this just a case of crowd mentality gone wild?
There is certainly a crowd effect with popularity with certain types of belief systems. And so beliefs are often relished, amplified, and defended by people who have extreme overvalued beliefs. And the belief just starts getting more dominant, more refined, more resistant to challenge. The person develops an intense emotional commitment to the belief. And examples of that, this binary thinking, would be like believing, like Nicholas Cruz did, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas high school shooter in Parkland, Florida, who actually posted, "I'm going to be a professional school shooter," on a YouTube. And so this kind of binary thinking, we think, are involved with extreme overvalued beliefs.
How would it be possible to be a professional school shooter when, you know, most of the time the school shooter ends up dead?
Yes, sometimes the suicide is part of the fantasy that the individual has. And in some cases, they do survive. But they do know that there's this thrill that they could die in the shooting. And sometimes they don't care if they die in the shooting. And the goal is to be a martyr and to be on this list of mass shooters to seek fame and in some ways to show I am important. You all rejected me, you school classmates, my family, whoever. And I am something. I'm bigger than all of you. In fact, I'm more important than all of you. And I'll show you how I'm more important than all of you. That's the kind of depraved thinking we're dealing with.
So you mentioned that these shared extreme overvalued beliefs are different from delusions. How are they different?
Delusions are often what psychiatrists would call fixed false beliefs that are idiosyncratic, meaning only that person believes it, and it usually stems from a psychiatric illness that's diagnosable, for instance, schizophrenia, bipolar disease. And usually these individuals will have a belief, for example, that they might believe that their neighbor is a space alien that's trying to take over the world and try to go do something about it, and maybe even try to kill that person. But most people with schizophrenia and severe mental disorders are not an elevated threat to the public. And if they do harm others, it's usually people around them, family members, neighbors. So that's a delusion. And an extreme overvalued belief, by contrast, is not usually associated with one of these severe diagnosable psychiatric illnesses. And so what I've done is create a new classification system, and you can find that on my website, scienceofextremism.com, where I show how to do a threat analysis. And my goal is to get everybody to learn these because they're not that hard to learn, and we can all start looking for them in people around us, even in loved ones, and try to do an intervention or try to get help.
So what are some of the red flags that indicate someone could be capable of committing mass violence?
So some of the markers, behavioral markers to think about are some of these binary thinking. For example, Black people are replacing white people. Abortion is always murder. The West is at war with Islam. Jews are disgusting. I vomit when I see one. I want to start a race war. I want to be a professional school shooter. The government is taking all of our guns away. So this kind of binary, absolute, simplistic thinking can be dangerous in some cases and can lead to extreme overvalued beliefs. And sometimes individuals who have these will do things like write manifestos, or they'll leak their thoughts, their fantasies to somebody that they know, or even to a stranger online, for instance. So in some of these other school shooters, there were plenty of behavioral markers present in which the individual was thinking about carrying out a mass shooting and actually told other people that they were thinking about doing it or bragging about it online, for instance.
Okay. Now, often these mass shootings do take place at schools, but there are other mass shootings that take place in a public place, like, for example, the Las Vegas shooting that happened a few years ago. What's the difference that causes someone to choose who, where to go wild and get violent?
Yeah, target selection can kind of depend on the environment that the person interacts with and works in. The Las Vegas shooter was very much interacting with casinos, and he was a big gambler and liked to be at the high roller tables, and may have had a grievance against some of the casinos. He filed a lawsuit against one of the casinos. I write about that in my book. And that may have been an important sign in his case. But target selection can often depend on the fixation that the individual has and the environment that they live or work in. And so many of the ideologically framed shooters or terrorists will pick targets based on some of their grievances that they may hold.
Okay. Now, as we talked about earlier, quite often the murderers die at the scene of the crime, whether by suicide or whether law enforcement takes them down. So then how is it possible to understand their motivation or get inside their heads and find out what they're thinking?
It's a good question. I think that in many cases, sometimes the person does survive and you do learn a lot about it from their story. So the way that if you've ever watched Mindhunter, the FBI way back in the 60s and 70s started collecting information about serial killers, and they would actually go to jail or prisons and interview the serial killer and say, you know, what are your fantasies? What are these sexual fantasies you have? And these prisoners told them a lot about how they behaved, what their fantasies were. And so the FBI started creating the MO, the modus operandi, which a lot of people are familiar with. So similar things can be done with these mass shooters. And so what's happened is my colleagues and friends that do a lot of research in this area have developed proximal and distal warning behaviors by collecting all of this information from lone actor terror attacks all over the world, even in the UK against the royal family, or in the United States or Germany with school shooters. And so there's just some things that have come out of this. And examples are being framed by an ideology, having a moral grievance, leaking the information to somebody, directly communicating a threat, identifying with previous shooters, pathway warning behavior, acquiring weapons, energy burst. There's about 18 of these, and you can find some of them on my website, scienceofextremism.com.
Okay. Now, what are some of the methods that mental health professionals and law enforcement are using to keep us safe?
That's a good question. And really, what I wanted to say is that there's a giant, not just a gap, but a canyon missing of public health approach to this. And by that, let me give you an example. If somebody poses a threat, let's say that they're fixated on QAnon or ISIS, like we saw what happened in Europe with Taylor Swift's concerts being canceled because of some teenage young men that were radicalized by ISIS. And so in the United States, one of the big concerns I have is that if a person poses a threat, we can either arrest them with law enforcement, in which case that would not hold in court because you really can't charge somebody with a crime who hasn't committed a crime. And physicians, psychiatrists like me, don't want these people in our offices because they're dangerous people. They're posing a threat by definition. So do we really want people carrying weapons into our doctor's offices and hospitals? No way. That would not be something we would want to deal with. So you'll hear psychiatrists say, well, that belongs over there with law enforcement. And you hear law enforcement say, well, that's a mental health issue. And so in the middle is where all this stuff gets lost. So neither of these two entities have a response that's directed towards thwarting, stopping, treating, et cetera. So it's not enough to just come in there and knock on the door and say, how you doing? It has to be taking the person's weapons, securing them, getting a crisis response team in there, dealing with the family, whatever other issues are going on in this person's life, because there may be substance use, there may be personality issues this individual has, there may be psychological factors this individual has. And I would kind of compare it to an eating disorder. I know that sounds weird, but anorexia is not something you just give a pill and an appointment to somebody and expect them to get better. You have to do work with these fixations that people develop. And so the analogy I use on my website is eating disorder treatment, which requires a full team to treat comorbid anxiety, depression, substance use, cognitive behavioral therapy, family therapy, and you personalize it to that person's situation. So it's not a cookie cutter for everybody. And so with this classification system I've developed, we can decide, hey, this person has psychosis. They have a delusion. We need to treat that with antipsychotics and civilly commit them to a hospital. Or they have extreme overvalued beliefs, which is not a severe mental illness, and you can't use civil commitment laws for them. But we could use other approaches and more of a kind of a public health, personalized care, jointly in crisis response teams. And this has been done. There's a model for this called Parents for Peace that also has a great website that you can check out, where radicalized individuals have been in treatment with folks that are interested in helping them. So it's not punitive. We're not putting people in prison. And that's another barrier. Who wants to see their loved one go to jail or prison because of their radical beliefs? So calling law enforcement on your family member is not an easy thing for people to do. So we have to have another approach. For example, in the Trump rally shooting, you know, the family was well aware that he was out to do something. They even called law enforcement themselves before Thomas Crooks went to the Trump rally to try to assassinate the president of the United States and ended up killing someone.
So if we were to see something suspicious going on, like members of the crowd mentioned that that shooter was acting suspiciously, is calling law enforcement the answer, or are there other things that we can do to prevent potential violence from happening?
That's a good question. I think it kind of depends on where the person is on their pathway. Obviously, if you see something, you say something at a place like a Trump rally or some other public place where somebody's acting unusual or is carrying weapons, that certainly is a red flag for calling law enforcement. But we really want to go way even before that, to way before they even get to a point that they're acquiring weapons to do something like that. And if you study some of these shooters, you'll find that classmates thought that they were disturbed and were afraid of them. Classmates even would say to their friends, that guy is going to be the next shooter, almost like a joke, but really with a serious tone to it. So it's not that these people snap overnight. They actually don't. There's a long radicalization process that occurs with the school shooters for certain, and for other kinds of lone actor terrorist attackers or assassins. They tend to study prior shooters and assassins. They tend to really start developing a fantasy about becoming one of them. And that fantasy, almost like the serial killer fantasy that I talked about earlier, starts translating into identifying with and acquiring both tactical knowledge and other types of information about prior shooters and trying to outdo them in some cases. You know, the Sandy Hook shooter, Adam Lanza, made a spreadsheet of 400 mass shooters that he ranked in order by body count. And it's pretty easy to see that he wanted to add his name to it. And one of the easiest ways that he could add his name to it was by killing these very young, small, innocent kids of Sandy Hook Elementary School, which is one of the most depraved things that we've ever encountered in this country's school shooting history.
So since friends, family, loved ones, acquaintances usually identify suspicious behavior before the shooting happens, does that suggest that gun control would be one of the answers?
It suggests that guns increase the lethality of attacks. But I'll remind people that Alec Manassian in Canada, he was an incel terrorist, involuntarily celibate, which is a type of terror group as well. They get inspired by the fact that they think that women should have sex with them. And if they don't, that means that the person should potentially radicalize and attack others, including women. So Elliot Roger was one of the first incel attackers in California. But Alec Manassian used a van in Toronto to run over a crowd. In Charleston, North Carolina, we saw an individual run into a crowd. And in the United Kingdom, we had knife attack problems recently. So there was a 17-year-old boy that attacked and killed three beautiful young girls and injured nine others in a knife attack. People have used bombs, explosives, knives, all kinds of instruments besides guns. So it's not going to end the problem to take guns away. I know that that sounds like a real easy solution to this, but unfortunately, most of the killing happens in the first 30 seconds also in a mass shooting. So this is a tough issue. I do think that some of the high lethality weapons, some of the rifles that have very large caliber bullets, can do so much more destruction than smaller caliber bullets. And so I've written on my website, scienceofextremism.com, that we could put guns into categories like A, B, and C, and that it would require a license to acquire weapons, and that the more lethal, highly dangerous, what some people would refer to as assault rifles or weapons of war, might be something that's just harder to acquire and that you would need to have, for example, a credit report, background check, things like that, something much more extensive. And the less lethal weapons could be easier to acquire with less invasive background checks. I do think that background checks for everybody would be a smart thing to do. But the higher lethality weapons, I kind of think of that as like getting a fireworks display license. You know, you got to know what you're doing. And pilots have to have a license. You can't just go fly a big jumbo jet unless you're qualified to do that. Doctors have licenses for different levels of drugs that we prescribe. You know, morphine is a very different drug to prescribe than a penicillin is. So we have licenses in our field to prescribe dangerous medications. And why not do the same thing with weapons? Instead of just saying, let's ban all of them, which is obviously unpopular in the United States with a lot of folks who live on farms or in rural areas especially. And so something more reasonable approach, I think, is better. And doing these kinds of checks on people would help us see some of these red flags and block that person from acquiring weapons.
And then now, if we're going to back it up even more, you talked about how these extreme overvalued beliefs kind of multiply when they start talking online and sharing them with other people, and it becomes like crowd mentality out of control. So what are some ways that we could prevent that from even happening in the first place?
That's a tough thing to do with free speech, right? So people don't want their social media censored by the government or by anyone else, and that's probably a good thing. At the same time, we want to protect society. And so I would argue that giving more information is always better. So we know, for instance, in the old days, we used to not talk about suicide. There was this belief back in the 1940s, 50s, that suicide was something you did not discuss. Well, research has shown that if you ask people about suicide, you're more likely to help stop that from happening by asking. So what's going on with the school shootings is kind of analogous to the 1940s and 50s with suicide, where there's a stigma associated with it. Students cannot bring up school shooters at school. They probably get in trouble or sent to the counselor about why they're asking those questions in some cases. So a taboo subject like this, it's really interesting. As a psychiatrist, I look around me at people have no problem talking about their sexuality or their gender or, you know, any of this stuff. But as soon as we start getting into this school shooting things, schools are very uncomfortable because they don't know, they haven't been educated on what this is. So one of my goals is to get this information out there so that schools can start having a healthy discussion with their children and their students about how individuals radicalize. Because right now, the belief out there is that people just snap one day and decide to go do one of these shootings, or that they're crazy and they need medicines, they have schizophrenia, all of which are myths and are wrong. So the research really tells us that these individuals often do not have a diagnosable psychiatric illness. They may have personality features and they radicalize by studying other shooters, and it almost becomes like a religion for them, online religion, to worship prior shooters, acquire weapons like previous shooters, and learn how to use them with a goal of fame seeking and dealing with their grievances through violence.
Yeah, okay. Now, it's obviously a sensitive topic and it's a very complicated topic. So you've mentioned your website, scienceofextremism.com. How can people find out more about this topic or even get your new book, Extreme Overvalued Beliefs?
Yes, that's a good question. I think Parents for Peace is a really good website to check out. For people who have mental disorders, NAMI, the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill, is a great resource. My book is available on Amazon and through Oxford University Press, and it's entitled Extreme Overvalued Beliefs, Clinical and Forensic Psychiatric Dimensions is the subtitle. And my last name is Rahman, R-A-H-M-A-N. I'm at Washington University and St. Louis School of Medicine, and my website is scienceofextremism.com.
Okay, awesome. So once again, scienceofextremism.com is the website to go to, scienceofextremism.com. That's Dr. Rahman's website. If you're a parent and you're interested in finding out more about this topic, Parents for Peace is a great website to check out. It's parents4peace.org if you want to go straight there, or you can just Google Parents for Peace. And of course, the book we've been talking about today, Extreme Overvalued Beliefs, is written by Dr. Tahir Rahman, who we've been talking to today, psychiatrist and the author of Extreme Overvalued Beliefs. And Dr. Rahman, it's been really fascinating talking to you. It's an interesting topic, a serious topic, a scary topic. And, you know, it's quite complicated, but obviously your new book examines it and pulls it apart and reveals some answers or some thoughts for consideration. So it's been great talking to you and finding out more about this and what we can possibly do. So once again, Dr. Rahman's website, scienceofextremism.com. And Dr. Rahman, thank you so much for your time today.
Heather, thank you so much for having me.
These days, my happy place feels a little happier, even if the fish aren't biting.
Mental health care is working for Diego. See what it can do for you at mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, September 9th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Unforgettables Foundation, and Monday, September 23rd at 8 p.m. benefiting the St. Rose Dominican Health Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. Aid for AIDS of Nevada, or AFAN, is holding their 38th annual Black and White Party in partnership with Clark County's Love, Live, Undetectable Equals Untransmittable campaign on Saturday, September 14th, starting at 8 p.m. at the Chaos Nightclub inside Palms Casino Resort, with VIP cocktail hour starting at 7 p.m. Get your tickets or find out more at afanlv.org. That's AFANLV.org. Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada are holding the 11th annual Sneaker Ball on Thursday, September 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Donald W. Reynolds Clubhouse, 2980 Robindale Road in Henderson. Guests are encouraged to wear their most stylish sneakers and take part in the activities that youth members enjoy at the 13 Boys and Girls Clubs throughout the valley. Find out more or get your tickets at bgcsnv.org. That stands for Boys and Girls Clubs, Southern Nevada, bgcsnv.org. Safe Nest, Nevada's largest nonprofit serving those affected by domestic and sexual violence, is hosting Pathways to Hope, a brunch fundraiser, on Saturday, September 21st at 10 a.m. at Red Rock Casino Resort and Spa. And their Run for Hope 5K and 1 mile walk are happening Sunday, October 13th at 8 a.m. at Wayne Bunker Park. Find out more, get tickets to the Pathways to Hope brunch, or register for the Run for Hope 5K at safenest.org. That's safenest.org. The Las Vegas Natural History Museum's signature fundraising gala, the 2024 Dinosaur Ball, will be held on Saturday, September 28th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. Find out more or get your tickets at dinoball.org. That's dinoball.org. ADL's annual Walk Against Hate is happening on Sunday, September 29th, with doors at 8:30 a.m. and program at 10 a.m. at Las Vegas Ballpark. Register to walk or find out more at walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. That's walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. The Shade Trees Once Upon a Gala is happening Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. in the Zouk Nightclub at Resorts World Las Vegas. The poolside VIP Secret Garden Soiree gets underway at 5:30 p.m. Get your tickets or find out more at theshadetree.org. That's theshadetree.org. The Nevada chapter of the Bleeding Disorders Foundation is holding their annual Unite for Bleeding Disorders Walk on Saturday, October 12th, with opening ceremonies at 10 a.m. and the walk starting at 10:30, followed by a picnic lunch at 11:15 a.m. at Floyd Lamb Park. Find out the details or register to walk at uniteforbleedingdisorders.org. That's uniteforbleedingdisorders.org. The Just One Project is hosting the fourth annual Big Cup Golf Tournament on Thursday, October 17th at the Revere Golf Club. Find out more or sign up to play at thejustoneproject.org. That's thejustoneproject.org. And Communities and Schools of Nevada is holding their 14th annual Today for Tomorrow fundraiser on Saturday, October 19th at 6 p.m. at Fontainebleau, Las Vegas. Find out more at cisnevada.org/event/TFT24. That's cisnevada.org/event/TFT24.